Make sure this is on. That sound okay? Henry Tai will come and give two lectures on string cosmology. And then I think later in the school, Lev Kaufman is going to come and talk about some more specialist topics. And I don't know what Lev's going to say, but I would imagine he might talk about some things like reheating after inflation and things like that. So I'm going to work as hard as I can to give sufficient material in introductory lectures to take you to where you should at least get a good grip of what those guys say. So that's going to be my primary goal here. I'm going to start off, I don't know exactly how much will fit today and how much will fit tomorrow and what things I'll end up sacrificing along the way, but I want to talk about cosmological spacetimes and symmetry. So try to just motivate why it is that we write down the ansatz that we do for cosmology in the context of general relativity. Then I'll talk about dynamics. This certainly will come today. And the matter content of the universe. And at this stage, I will be talking about matter only in the broadest terms, so in terms of perfect fluids, dust, radiation, and treating things like the cosmological constant or a possible dark energy component also as perfect fluids. And then I'll probably almost today, talk about, well, since I'm calling it the universe today, I should talk about it today. Otherwise, it'll be the universe tomorrow. Universe today and dark energy. And within this section, I'll try to talk about the microwave background briefly. I'll talk about Big Bang nuclear synthesis extremely briefly. I'll talk about the supernova results and maybe a couple of other things. The purpose in this section will be to give you a feeling for how it is we know that the universe is composed of the various components of the matter budget that we believe it to be composed of. And then in the next part, I'll kind of abandon some of the things we talked about here when we treated the matter as, you know, this kind of perfect fluid, and I'll move on to the early universe. But not too early. And I'll talk about, if I get time, I will talk about baryogenesis, the question of how the matter-antimatter asymmetry may have arisen. Thermal relics, I'll certainly try to say something about thermal relics, both in the context of dark matter and in the context of topological defects, with an eye to setting up some of the topics that Henry will talk about in some detail. And finally, I'll hopefully give an introduction to inflation, setting up partly what Henry will say and almost certainly part of what Lev will say. So this is the plan. Okay. So let me get started. And so let me start with cosmological spacetimes. Please yell if I'm speaking too loudly, too softly, too quickly, too slowly, or any of the above, or if I'm writing too large or too small. Cosmological spacetimes. Now, in cosmology, there are two major assumptions that we make. These assumptions are borne out wonderfully by observations of the universe that I'll get to in a while, but for now they're really going to just be assumptions. And those, so we will assume homogeneity and isotropy. So homogeneity meaning that there is no preferred point in space, and isotropy meaning that given a point in space and you look around in all directions, there's no preferred direction in space. Okay. Now, if you make these two assumptions, the form which your metric can take when you think about general relativity is quite simple. But I want to kind of give you a kind of very quick sketch of why it takes the form it does, because I don't think people usually do this, and it's actually an instructive thing to see, I think. And the sketch I'll give won't involve general relativity or anything like that at all. It'll just be a quick sketch. So I want to start off by saying, okay, we're going to think about an isotropic spacetime. So I'm going to work in spherical polar coordinates, and I'm going to sit at the origin, and I'm going to draw a very large triangle. So here's the triangle I want to draw. Everyone can see that okay at the back? Yep, thanks. I'll drop this perpendicular exactly halfway along, and I'll label, and I want to drop another perpendicular a little further along, some arbitrary point, and I'm going to label all the points. A, well, we draw this line, B, C, D, E, not particular order here, F, G, and H. And I'll also draw the arc from this origin like this and call that point F prime. And I'll label the angles here, gamma. I'll call this distance there to there R, this distance there to there X. And I'll call this angle gamma because it's the same angle by isotropy, and that angle beta. So why do I want to draw such a strange angle? You should think of this angle as just being in the plane around you from your origin. And I want to draw it because I just want to show you why it is that the cosmological spacetimes take the form they do. And so choosing up this point as the origin, using the coordinates r, theta, phi, then the spatial line element must take the form d sigma squared is dr squared plus some function that can only be a function of r, because otherwise I violate isotropy, d theta squared plus sine squared theta dr squared. And I'm not going to go into this in great detail. I just want to sketch how one can show this. And f of r is a real function. And f of r, if you want the metric to be non-singular at the origin, should go like r as r goes to 0. And now, on this diagram, you can do you can make small angle approximations and do a little bit of elementary calculations. And you will see, and I'm not going to just keep saying well, how I show these things, it should be fairly obvious, that the distance EF, which is approximately equal to the distance EF prime, is equal to F of 2r times gamma, but it's also equal to F of r times beta. So that's comparing this triangle to that triangle. And also AC is gamma F of r plus x. That's just using this triangle. Oh, thanks. And that's also equal to AB plus BC, which is gamma F of r minus x plus beta F of x. So I'm just doing, you know, simple distances in these radial coordinates. But the nice thing just about doing it this way is that I can put these together. Put these two formulae together and eliminate beta over gamma. And what I end up with, if I take the limit as x goes to 0, is the following formula. So my differences become a differential. Is the following differential equation. So it's easy to show by putting these two expressions together that that following and then taking the limit as x goes to 0, that you have the following differential equation. And remember that I also had r goes f goes to r as r goes to 0. And now if you would, for example, try to series solve those equations, you would see that there are exactly three solutions. You can check that there are only three solutions. And the three solutions are up to normalization, f of r is r, f of r is sine r, and f of r is sine char. And you're done. Now, let me go over here. So the metric, the most general spherically, the most general isotropic homogeneous metric that you can have, and now I'll just elevate this to a space-time metric, is the following. Oops. Now I have to allow for the fact that things can expand in time. And that's the most general metric I have, with f taking one of these three forms. And I haven't said anything about how this fits into Einstein's equations or anything else yet. Okay. So without doing general relativity yet, without worrying about any of that, you know already that if you have homogeneity and isotropy, there are only three forms the metric can take, and it's these three forms. Okay. Now, this is the form that, this is not really the form you're used to seeing the metric in cosmology. You're used to seeing in different forms, so let me write those down now. So that was just a kind of short exercise. People need this up at all yet? No? So let me now write this down in a couple of different forms that are very useful to cosmologists. So one is to redefine R. If I redefine R, I get the following. Ds squared is minus dt squared plus a squared of t dr squared over 1 minus kr squared plus r squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. And this is the form you may be more used to seeing it in. And this is what we call the Friedman-Robertson-Walker line element. Okay. K here is a parameter. K positive, I'll be able to say this, K positive corresponds to F equals sine R. K negative corresponds to F equals sine R. And K zero corresponds to F equals R. And K zero is, of course, clearly just a flat case. It's just a flat metric in here. Notice that I didn't say k equals plus 1, minus 1, or 0, which is what you often hear in cosmology. I am going to start using that in a moment, but that's an extra scaling that you do, extra freedom that you have. Maybe I should say that a different way first. In cosmology, what you'll often hear is that people will say, well, the scale factor is the thing that describes distances between points as time goes on. And then they'll say, we're free to rescale that any way you want, and so we'll set A today, and I'll usually use this notation sub-zero to mean today. They'll usually set A0 as 1, okay? Which is a fine thing to do as long as the space is flat. But if it's not spatially flat, you're not free to do that. And I'll show you why that is when I come to write down the Friedman equation. So this is just a caveat. Oftentimes, when people are doing late universe cosmology, I'll talk about this a lot, they're dealing with flat universes. We have great observational data that they're flat today, and they'll just do this automatically. If you read cosmology papers these days, they'll do it without saying it or thinking. So that's why I want to point it out. But if you're doing early universe cosmology, and if many of you are interested in strings and quantum gravity or such things, you're going to care deeply about how the universe got to be flat. So you'd like to start off with it not flat. And if you do that, you're not allowed to do this and set k to be plus 1, minus 1, or 0. Okay. So before I go on to more meaningful parts of what I want to say, let me write down one other form for this metric, which cosmologists use. This is a very handy form for us because this is really cosmic time. Observers that are fixed in these coordinates just fall along geodesics as that time evolves. But it's often useful for calculations to do the following. So to define conformal time, by the following, tau, sometimes this gets called eta, I'm going to call it tau. Tau of t is defined to be the integral to t dt prime over a of t prime. And by doing that, one puts the metric into the following form. And there's a convention here. I'm going to write a squared of tau. Of course, what I really mean is a squared of tau of t, but I'm just going to call that function a squared of tau. That's a convention. You should be aware of that. Okay. And now, obviously, and particularly when the case is flat here, you can just see this is just conformal to flat space. Okay. All right. So some more definitions. So the Hubble parameter defined in terms of this metric is defined as h of t is defined to be a dot divided by a. And the Hubble parameter, as we'll see soon, is incredibly important because it describes at any time t how distant galaxies appear to be moving from us because of this metric, and in the form that the velocity of distant galaxies is approximately equal to h times their distance from us. And that, of course, is Hubble's law. I'm going to call this the Hubble parameter as much as I can without misspeaking, and I'm going to reserve the word Hubble constant for the value of this thing today. Since it's the value today, it's obviously constant, but I'm going to try to do that anyway, just to pick them up. Yes? Oh, the dot here is with respect to t. Yes. Yeah, and I will be consistent with that throughout, too. If I want to deal with conformal time, which I will in a couple of places, I'm going to call to give that a prime. Yeah. OK, any more questions? OK, so let's go on. So this is Hubble's law that I wrote down here, and obviously is the prima facie evidence for the expanding universe. Go on. So this is just a description of what the kind of metrics are that we deal with in cosmology. So let me move on now to dynamics. Obviously, what we're going to do is use the Einstein equation. We're going to use this ansatz within the Einstein equation. Okay. So before I do that, obviously, I need to tell you what kind of matter I'm going to put in. So what do I put here on the right-hand side? And since I'm making an ansatz for the metric that is both homogeneous and isotropic, I'm going to need to make an ansatz for the matter content that is also homogeneous and isotropic. Okay. So I need homogeneous and isotropic ansatz for the matter content. And to do that, I will use the perfect fluid. So the perfect fluid takes the following form for the energy momentum tensor. Where rho here is the energy density. P here is the pressure of the fluid, both measured in the rest frame. Okay. So the fluid elements are co-moving in this cosmological rest frame. They just move along with the expansion. And so if you wanted to write in these coordinates what that u mu was, you would write it as u mu is 1, 0, 0. Zero, but I'll just leave it this way for variant life. So without resorting to that, the energy momentum tensor looks like the following. Its 0, 0 component is the energy density. It has nothing up here and up here, down here, and then it has P, G, I, J. Where by gij, I mean the spatial parts of this metric, including the a squared of t. Okay. Let me go here. So now we have both an appropriate ansatz for cosmology for the metric. We have a homogeneous and isotropic ansatz for the types of matter that we will conclude. So now we're ready to write down the Einstein equations for cosmology and see what differential equations will govern the behavior of the metric. Okay. So the Einstein equations give give the following equations. The first Einstein equation, the 0, 0, is of course the constraint equation. It's the same as true here. So h squared, which of course is defined to be a dot by a squared, is 8 pi g by 3 times the energy density minus, and by the, well, maybe I should, I'm going to write this in slightly general form, sum over I rho I. By that I mean, if I have multiple fluid components, you just add up all their energy densities. It'll just be useful for me to make that explicit. Minus k over a squared. Okay. This is called the Friedmann equation. And from here, you can see why I made a fuss earlier about what you're allowed to define away and what you're not. Because if k is 0, then I can go ahead and measure the Hubble constant, say today, and I can measure the energy densities today, and that's all there is to it. It doesn't explicitly depend on the value of the scale factor today, what I do there. So I'm, in particular, I'm allowed to say, well, let's just say the scale factor is 1 today, the way that I suggested over here. But if k is not 0, then you know I get to measure the Hubble constant today, and I get to measure things like the mass density and the rest of the stuff in the universe today. And then I'm left with this term, and I can either choose to normalize the modulus of k to be 1, or zeroed, if it's 0, or I can choose to set a today to be 1, but I can't do both. Okay, so typically what cosmologists do is they always normalize mod k as 1 or 0, in the case of the flat universe. And then in the case of the flat universe, we'll use a 0 as 1, and the rest of the time we won't have that freedom. Is that clear? Yeah. Is the right-hand side positive definite? It will need to be positive definite, yeah. And that'll put some constraints on the kinds of dynamics that are allowed to come out of this. I'll talk a little bit about that when we get to cosmological constant in particular. But yes, of course, it must be positive definite. OK, so the second Einstein equation gives us, well, actually, combining the second Einstein equation with this equation gives us the following equation. A double dot over A plus, actually this is just the second Einstein equation, 1/2 A dot by A squared is minus 4 pi G sum over I pi, where I'm allowing again for multiple fluids, minus K over 2 A squared. Okay. Now, that's it. Those are the only equations, the only independent equations that come out of the Einstein equations, because we have such a simple form for the metric. There's only one unknown. It's sometimes useful to combine these two, and it will be very useful when we come to talk about inflation and the late time acceleration of the universe. It's useful to combine to give the acceleration equation. So I'll be referring to this, so I'll write it down. And that equation is just a double dot over a. So this is why it's called the acceleration equation. It tells you by a double dot over a is minus 4 pi g by 3, the sum over I of rho I plus 3 p I. One thing you'll notice about this equation is that nowhere does k appear in it. And that should tell you something. And what it tells you is that if you had a universe dominated purely by curvature, and of course that would have to be negative curvature to satisfy the question you asked a moment ago, then that would be a coasting universe with no acceleration. Okay, so you'd have to, it just doesn't appear in here at all. Okay. Okay. Now, what this equation tells us is how the scale factor evolves. Notice that I haven't said anything yet about equations of motion for the matter. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But actually, it turns out that certainly for this perfect fluid we have, you can just combine these two, and I can tell you what the equation of motion for the matter is. But I'll show you how that works out in a moment rather than doing it now. There's only going to be two independent equations that we use. These two would be fine. It's actually simpler to use the equation of motion for the matter and the Friedmann equation, but we'll come back to that. So you can use the Friedman equation. To define, and an important thing to say here is that any time, and again, if you read cosmology papers, these quantities often get referred to very loosely just as the density, the critical density, things like that that I'm going to talk about in a moment. But what they mean is today, usually in papers. Okay, but you can define this at any time, and it's actually important to do that, to define something called a critical density, which is 3h squared over 8 pi g, critical density. So you can think of this any number of different ways, but one way to think about it would be to say, given a value of the Hubble constant that you want to see today, how much stuff do you have to put in the universe to ensure that the spatial sections are flat? Okay. So given how fast the universe is expanding today, that's a value for h, or at any time, h, how much stuff do you have to put in at that time so that your the Friedman equation demands that k must be zero? Okay? That's what we call the critical density, the density for which the spatial sections would be flat. Okay? So if, just to be pedantic, if sum of a row equals a row critical, then k equals zero. Okay. So then I'm going to define the density parameter to be omega total, defined to be rho, where rho here means the sum over rows, all the rho. Okay, I'm just going to get tired of writing sum over rho, is rho over rho critical. Right? So rho over rho critical, this quantity omega total, is of course obviously deeply related to the curvature of the spatial sections. If k equals 0, then you must have omega total is 1. And so there is this relationship that omega total greater than 1, the same as k equals plus 1. I mean k positive, but I'm going to make this normalization consistently throughout. Omega total equals 1 is, as I said, clearly k equals 0. And omega total less than 1 is the same as k is minus 1. And what's nice about this is that you can go out and make measurements of the universe, as we'll see later, that tell you, you can imagine going out and making measurements of the universe and adding up how much of the different components of the stuff in the universe you have, comparing them to the critical density, for which all you need to know is the Hubble constant, and figuring out what the value of omega is today, omega total. And by that, you would know whether you're living in a universe with flat spatial sections, curved spatial sections, positively or negatively. And that's going to be very important as I go on and talk more about what the CMB tells us, and also about some of the fundamental problems which we get faced with when we look at the evolution of the universe today. Any more questions about that? Okay, so just as I can define omega total, I'll also define fractions of the critical density. So if I'm going to define omega total to be this, obviously there's a very handy thing I can do, which is to define omega I, which is of course defined to be how much of the critical density is in each different component in the universe. And again, if you read lots of cosmology papers or if you listen to the rest of my lecture, I'm going to talk about this a lot. So I'm going to start saying things like omega baryon, omega dark matter, omega dark energy, omega lambda. And I'll sometimes even say omega curvature, which is a little bit of a cheat, as I'll show in a moment. And I'll mean how much of the total contribution to the critical energy density comes in each different form of matter. Okay, and this is the way cosmologists keep track of the different contributions to the energy budget of the universe. Okay. All right, back to matter. What about the matter equation of motion? Well, We all know what the matter equation of motion should be. So the matter equation of motion comes from energy momentum conservation. And that, of course, means that del mu t mu nu should be zero. So locally, energy momentum should be conserved. And what does that tell us? Well, you can just do this. You can figure out the Christoffel symbol for that space-time I showed you, and you can plug in that t mu nu that I showed you, use that value for u mu, and you get an answer. And so the answer you get is the following: rho dot plus 3 h rho plus p is zero. Now you should have expected this. Well, maybe you shouldn't have expected it, but it's clear that that equation and any one of these is equivalent to the other one. So in particular, it is very easy for you to show by differentiating the Friedmann equation, you'll get yourself a rho dot on the right-hand side, and then using rho dot from here, and then reusing the Friedmann equation, it's very easy for you to reproduce this equation. Okay, so these are not independent equations. And in fact, what I will typically use in as many places as is humanly possible, it will be this equation and the Friedmann equation. But there'll be a couple of places where I really care about what's going on with the acceleration, like inflation, like dark energy, and then I'll start referring to the acceleration equation again. So I'll use them all interchangeably. Okay, now, obviously, so far I haven't solved anything. I'm sure it hasn't escaped your notice. And the reason is I don't have enough information yet. So I've given you a very simple ansatz. I've given you a set of differential equations that the only free function in that ansatz obeys, and I've given you an energy source. But I have no energy momentum source, but there's one thing remaining, and I need to supply. So what's left is, so you need to supply an equation of state. Now, it's a phrase you hear a lot in thermodynamics, and it can mean many different things. But for my purposes here, it means a relationship that relates p to rho in this equation. So I want to write down p as a function of rho. Obviously, there are many, many, many things within the universe that could be in the universe that for which that is not possible strictly. And I'm going to use the cosmologist's favorite friend, a scalar field, in a while. And for that, it's not possible, although it's possible in some asymptotic regimes. But for a perfect fluid like this, it's okay for me to write down p as p of rho. And in fact, it is often convenient to write p equals w rho. We call this the equation of state parameter, which is a little bit unfair at first glance, because parameter makes you feel like it's basically a constant that you put in. Now, I told you really that p can be a function of rho, but what's going to happen is for many of the sources that I care about, it's going to be a very good approximation. In fact, exact for some of them, that w is a constant. So that's why this becomes useful. Okay? All right. So if you like, this is an instantaneous definition. Of All right. Now before I go on, now I have enough information to solve the equations, but before I start doing that, it'd be good to kind of take a step back and get a little bit of physical intuition about what you expect these equations to do. So in the case of matter, what kinds of matter are there in the universe which you've heard of? And certainly the most obvious one is what cosmologists call dust. So dust for us is pressureless matter. Pressureless matter for us could mean many things, but typically these days it means clusters of galaxies. So we're very modest as cosmologists. We're like, dust is a cluster of galaxies. And that's the rest of the details of that are for astrophysicists. But what would you expect pressureless matter to do? So if you take a big enough box and you've got a lot of lumps of pressureless matter, which for simplicity, let's think all have the same mass, what would you expect the energy density in that big box to do as you increase the size of the box? And obviously the answer is, well, the mass of each of these objects doesn't change, so the energy density in the box is proportional just to the number density of objects in the box, and you double the size of the box, and the number density drops by the size of the box inverse cubed. Okay, it goes down like the volume. So you would expect automatically, I'll just sketch this here and write it over here in a moment, that for dust, you expect the energy density as a function of the scale factor to go like a to the minus 3. The universe doubles in size, the number density of objects, which are non-relativistic and therefore pressureless, should drop by a factor of a cubed. Now, the other kind of matter that you're very, very familiar with is radiation. A gas of radiation is the gas of photons. And what happens to the same thing if you take a gas of photons, you put them in a big box, and you double the size of the box? And what happens is, well, the number density does indeed drop, but also every photon gets redshifted. And so the energy density for radiation, you expect, and I'm not solving the equations here, by the way, I'm just giving you a kind of hand-wavy argument, should go like, so let me call this, I'm going to call this rho matter, just so we don't get confused. Rho radiation should go like 1 over a cubed for the number density dropping and an extra 1 over a for the redshifting of photons. And it turns out this is good that you have this intuition, because it's exactly what happens when you actually solve the equations. So it's very easy for you to solve this equation, because this equation just tells you that d rho by dA is equal to 1 plus W rho, rho over A. So all I've done there is to write the Hubble parameters A dot over A, and to write rho P equals W rho, and then divide through by A dot. And that equation you can most certainly solve. That equation will tell you that rho as a function of A is, well, proportional to is all I really care about. Maybe I'll write it sensible way, is rho zero times A zero over A to the 3-1 plus W. So I've imposed that today when A equals A zero, rho should be rho zero. And that clearly, with dust and radiation, the simple things I just talked about, dust is pressureless matter. Therefore, P matter is zero. Therefore, W matter is zero. And if you put W equals zero in there, you'll see it's 1 over A cubed. Whereas radiation, if you go to your StatMech book, and I'll do a little more of this in a while when I come to the Yule universe part and do some thermodynamics, radiation is, of course, a gas of photons. It is not pressureless. But in fact, it obeys P radiation is 1/3 rho radiation. And so that means that W radiation is 1/3. If you put 1/3 into that equation, you'll see that, in fact, you get rho goes like 1 over a to the 4th. And so your intuition, again, holds. OK. Any questions about that? OK. Now, you'll notice that there's something very important that I haven't done yet. And that is, I haven't once mentioned the cosmological constant. And in fact, I didn't put it anywhere in the equations I used either. So it was missing from here, it was missing from here. And so why is that? Well, it's not because I don't want to talk about the cosmological constant, because it's very important to cosmology these days. But rather, it's because I am going to, just for simplicity's sake, treat it as an additional matter component rather than part of the, if you like, the geometry side of the Einstein's equations. It doesn't mean that I philosophically think of it that one way or the other. It's just going to be handy for me to do it one way and not the other. Okay. A cosmological constant, and I'll have more to say about this later as well. Still haven't solved the Einstein equation yet, but we're getting there. Cosmological constant. It's equivalent to, as you know, to a component of the energy density, a component of rho total. In fact, you could write it as having an energy momentum tensor, T mu nu lambda, which is just minus lambda over 8 pi g, g mu nu. Okay, if you do that, then you'll automatically appear in the Einstein, in the Friedmann equation the way it does. And that, of course, is just a perfect fluid. It falls exactly into the form of a perfect fluid that I wrote down, except with, so it's a perfect fluid, with P lambda equals minus rho lambda. And rho lambda is lambda over 8 pi g. So it's going to be convenient for me to talk about the cosmological constant as a perfect fluid. And the primary reason it's going to be convenient for me is that I'm going to talk about dark energy later. And so I want to talk about what kinds of stuff could be out there that causes the universe to accelerate. And I'd just like to lump the cosmological constant in the spectrum of what that stuff could be. And so it's handy for me to talk about it as one of these perfect fluids. Okay. So I've really included the cosmological constant in what I said over there. Secretly, and obviously, I will talk about W lambda as being minus 1. Obviously, that works if you put minus 1 in that equation, rho does not evolve. It's a constant. And since we're on the topic of defining things to be part of the energy momentum tensor when they might be or might not be, although the cosmological constant is fair enough, I'm going to do something now which is not really fair enough, but it's okay as a trick. I'm going to try to get rid of this curvature. So occasionally, I won't do this all the time. Sometimes it's useful to think of, that's important, the curvature as an energy component. And it won't take you long staring at those equations to realize that can be done quite easily. And it's done by having rho curvature defined to be minus 3k over 8 pi g a squared, and peak curvature to be k over 8 pi g a squared. And so W curvature, if I wanted to be perverse and define that, would be minus 1/3. And that's precisely the reason that in this acceleration equation, if you were to put W curvature as W is minus 1/3, this would vanish. That's why you don't see K in that equation at all. Doesn't contribute to acceleration or deceleration. This is just a trick, of course. Okay, it's just handy at times. Sometimes I'll refer to it that way. Okay, before I solve the equations, one last, here we've been making progress. I just want to backtrack and make one last definition. And that is that, I should have said this when I was talking about radiation, something you know. So because you're in an expanding universe, radiation gets redshifted. How does it get redshifted? And that is that, if you emit a photon with wavelength lambda emitted, and you observe it at an observer sometime later in the universe with wavelength lambda observed, then lambda observed divided by lambda emitted is, of course, the ratio of the two scale factors. Okay, as the photon makes its way from, say, a distant galaxy to you, it gets stretched out, lambda gets increased, and we define this relationship to be 1 plus the redshift. Okay. So in general, I'm clearly relating here redshift to the redshift of the wavelengths of photons, but often cosmologists will just then abstract this and talk about the redshift as 1 plus z is a 0, which is often 1 if we're in a flat universe, divided by the scale factor. And we'll just use this relationship sometimes as another variable in our cosmology. Okay, so I should just write there that this is called a redshift. It's another way of keeping track of time in the universe. Okay, today we're at redshift 0. All right. So now let me move on to actually what the solutions to the Einstein equations are. How does the universe evolve in the presence of this matter governed by Einstein's equations? And I'll come here. We already know how the matter itself evolves as a function of the scale factor. So if we can solve for the scale factor now, we'll know everything about the zero mode evolution of the universe. So let's start easy. Flat universes. So for flat universes with k equals 0, you can really use any coordinates you like. It doesn't really matter. Equations are very easy to solve. You take this equation over here. I'm going to tell you what kind of row is the dominant kind of row. You're going to solve that differential equation. I'm certainly not going to go ahead and solve it here because it's an easy thing to do. But suffice it to say that if the universe contains only one component of rho total, or is dominated by one, close enough, then there's a simple solution to that equation, and the solution is A of t is a zero. I'll just leave that explicit for now. T over t zero to the 2/3 1 plus W. It's a Powell law evolution. I should say, unless W is minus 1, in which case A of t goes like e to the ht, the constant h. So what does that mean? So it means for dust, A of t goes like t to the 2/3. And for radiation, A of t goes like t to the 1/2. And it's incredibly important for the evolution of the universe that these powers be different and that they be in this order. So that even though, as we'll say more about later, even though today we're dominated either by cosmological constant or dust, let's say, at early times, this will be the dominant component, as we'll see. All right. So note that A goes to 0 as t goes to 0. Okay. So both universes begin with a big bang. Okay. This is a singularity. A equals 0. And given that they have a beginning, at any time you can ask, how old are they? And the Friedmann equation should be able to tell you that. So the age of the universe is given by, well, t0 is, of course, the integral t0 dt, which via the Friedman equation, well, not via the Friedman equation, via a change of variables, one can write as the integral from 0 to 1 dA over a h of a. So I'm choosing to write the Hubble parameter as a function of the scale factor here. So let's substitute in for a here and use that a dot over a is h. And now one could substitute functionally the form for h from here, knowing how rho evolves with a, and you would just have an integral over some function of a. And so if you do that using what we got here, so you'll find that the answer is 2 over 3, 1 plus w h0. Okay, so that's the equation for the age of the universe in a universe dominated by a one particular type of matter for all of its evolution, w not equal to minus 1, of course, when the spatial sections are flat. Right. And you'll notice that this is, you know, of the order of 1 over h naught. And so it's useful, typically, unless you're in a particularly weird type of universe, to speak of the age of the universe as being 1 over the Hubble constant. Okay? If you measure, if you had existed at any point in the evolution of the universe, and you had measured the Hubble parameter at that time, you would know that the age of the universe at that time was of the order of the inverse of that quantity. Okay. This gets a name because of that. So 1 over h naught gets a name. It's called the Hubble time. Actually, in a radiation-dominated universe, if you put w as 1/3 in there, you'll see that t0 is exactly 1 over h0. So they coincide for that, but they do not coincide always. Okay. Obviously, if you're in a universe with many types of matter, which are dominant for different proportions of cosmic history, you can't do this nice analytic integral. You know, rho would no longer have just been rho of a with a given by one of these. You would instead have some sum, part radiation, part matter, part cosmological constant, part dark energy, part neutrino, part whatever you like. And if you want to calculate the age of the universe in such a model, obviously what you have to do is just numerically integrate that, and you get an age for the universe. So part of what goes on when people tell you that they've extrapolated the age of the universe is that they've measured how much stuff there is in different components in the universe, they've plugged it into a cosmological model, they've then evaluated this integral. That's what they mean by the age of the universe. Okay, so that's all I really have to say about flat universes, because you can just solve everything for flat universes. It's nice and easy. What about curved, including spatial curvature? Let me do that now. And I don't want to spend an inordinate amount of time on this, but it's worth having the equations at hand, because it's surprising how often you need them when you want to think about what kind of things are responsible for the current day flatness of the universe. So including curvature. So if you do that, then, well, it's easier to work in conformal time. Tau. If you do that, then the Einstein equations become the following. I'll define this little h in a moment. And here I have defined little h of tau to be a prime by a, and a prime denotes, as I said earlier, a derivative with respect to conformal time. Okay. So the Einstein equations become this, and then you can actually just go ahead and solve these for h, and I'm just going to write down what you obtain. And A of t, A of tau, therefore, is 1 minus cos tau, tau squared by 2, cosh tau minus 1. These are k equals 1, 0, minus 1. And obviously, this is nice. You've solved the equation, but you haven't quite completed what you wanted to do, because you'd really like to get A of t. And so to complete that, at least formally, I can tell you what t of tau is. And t of tau is proportional to tau minus sine tau, tau cubed over 6, sinh tau minus tau, values for k. Okay? So this tells you how to solve the Einstein equations completely, including curvature, for any I should have said this at the beginning. That's a shame. This is for matter. W equals 0. Okay, and one could do similar things for radiation. They look similar, they're not the same, and I'm not going to just write them down on the board here, but I'll provide some notes, and it'll be in there. The point being just to show that it's easy to get these solutions. Yes? Well, it depends what you mean by the curvature. The curvature certainly is time dependent. I mean, by that I mean the spatial curvature of this action. Of course, if the universe is expanding, the curvature really is changing. But what I mean by the curvature when I say including curvature here is I mean putting back in that k factor. So for our purposes here, k is normalized to be plus minus 1 or 0, and the changing curvature comes about via the 1 over a squared term. So there's a physical measure of the spatial curvature that's indeed changing, but the curvature parameter is normalized to be 1 at all times. No. K cannot be time dependent. I mean, in the equation for the metric, there's various things that can be time dependent, but you get to choose where to put your time dependence. If you put it in one place, it won't appear in the other place. If you put it in both places, the evolution will just be, you know, the physical things you measure will be the same, but the solutions to the equations will just look different until you put everything together. In the form that I wrote down for the metric, so in there, I've already decided I'm going to normalize k. Already. It's a question of how a relates to k, right? If I decide that k is going to depend on t, I can absorb that into my definition of a. And that's explicit here, actually, in terms of the Friedman equation. That's what I meant when I went into this kind of song and dance about whether I'm allowed to set k equal 1 and a to a be 1. Okay? So choose to normalize k to be plus minus 1. Or 0, and then all the physical curvature goes into the value of A. So if you write down things like what is the Ricci scalar at some time, okay, then what appears in there is a function of A. It'll involve K2, but K is a constant, and it's the evolution of A that will tell you that curvature. So no, it doesn't play. You can't make a transition from being, I think you're asking, can you make a transition from being in a open, well, what I'm going to call an open universe to a closed universe, and the answer is no. So now move on. Okay, so now we have solutions for the equations of motion. We've solved them kind of exactly in a lot of cases of interest when we have radiation or dust. And those are actually significant portions of cosmic evolution. The universe was dominated by dust for a long time. It was dominated by radiation for a reasonably long time. But now I want to go back and talk about some more general features of universes which look this way, with a constant equation of state parameter. And the one thing I want to just mention is horizons. So many of you will have a very good understanding of horizons. I just want to be clear what I mean when I talk about horizons in the context of cosmological spacetimes. So let me just be very clear and define two concepts of what I mean by horizons. So suppose, and I think I'll just, the equations that I write down here, I'll probably just restrict myself to flat universes for simplicity. So suppose an emitter, E, sends a light signal to an observer. O, who is standing at r equals 0. And of course, the thing to think about here is you waiting for light from distant galaxies to arrive. Okay. And I'm going to set, since I am free to do this, theta phi constant. In that case, so we have radial null rays. Okay, it's light, and it's theta and phi a constant. You have T0, so these you have radial null rays. And if you look at the metric, that tells you that tau 0 minus tau, so I'm working in conformal time here because it's very convenient, is equal to R. Okay, so I'm being flat here, k equals 0. So I'm just, and since I'm working in conformal time, it's simple to write this down. Okay, so that implies tau 0 minus tau e, so for this particular null ray, is equal to re. Okay, so the difference in conformal times between emission and absorption is given by r, the radius of the emitter. But now, suppose tau e is bounded below by tau e bar. Okay. For example, the Big Bang singularity. Okay. In other words, there is a time before which things cannot have been sending messages to you. Then there is a maximum distance to which the observer can see. And we're going to call this distance the particle horizon distance. Does anyone have the time? Say that again. 3:35? Okay. It's the particle, so we'll call this the particle horizon distance. And it's given by R particle horizon T0. Is tau 0, the tau 0 is tau 0 minus tau e bar. I'll try to draw a little picture to illustrate what that means. So this is r, and this is tau. This is r equals 0. Slightly abuse what I mean by r here, the world line of the observer. Then it just means this, okay? So just, there's nothing more than a particle. And so particles in here you've already seen, and particles out here you've not seen yet. So that's what I'll mean by the particle horizon. And similarly, I'll say this quickly. if kernel 0 is bounded above by tau 0 bar, then there's actually an event horizon. With distance R event horizon, tau 0 is tau 0 bar minus tau E. And I'm going to the trouble of defining these things, which I think are concepts that are very familiar to you all, but I'm defining them in terms that I want to, because these are going to be very important when I talk about some of the problems of the standard cosmology and start to motivate inflation. Okay? So let me just draw a little picture for this to be done with horizons. So that means that there's a bound up here, and there's the emitter now. The emitter is getting light rays, and here you received the message. And here, you never receive the message. There's only so many people you can communicate with. Okay. So that's just a short description of what I mean by horizons and cosmological spacetimes. I use them again when I come to talk about inflation. Okay. Just one more thing to say about maybe about these things is just that you can convert these to the proper distance, proper distances. So I've given you only the coordinate distance r. I want to tell you how really how far away they are in the following way, of course. The distance to the horizon, I'll do the, let me do the particle horizon here just as an example, is scale factor at time tau times the coordinate distance. So that's one of the reasons that the conformal time is so simple to use here. That's just the answer. Of course, you'd really like to know it in terms of real cosmic time. But since we know that, we can write so that's the distance, the physical distance to the particle horizon at time t. Okay. And further outside than the particle horizon, nothing can have influenced you if you've been evolving the entire time with the scale factor a of t. Okay. And one thing we're going to see is that you, when you look out at the night sky, you see many, many places on the night sky which were never in contact with one another, and yet you'll see that they have stunningly similar properties. And one of the questions we'll have to answer is, how come? All right. Rob, when do you want people to finish up? How far before the 1.5 hour mark? Oh, OK. Maybe you'll wave at me, and I've got 10 minutes till the end. Will you do that? All right, thanks. OK, so one last thing. Well, maybe not one last thing, but final thing to say. And the goal of what I want to say here is just to dispel a bunch of language that crept into cosmology and then had to be kicked out of cosmology forcefully in the last few years. I never said it myself, but other people did. But and this is basically about geometry and destiny. Namely, if you figure out a bunch of stuff about how the spatial surface is a curve, what can you say about the future of the universe? Can you say anything about it? And the answer from a local theory should be no, and the answer, of course, is no, but people did let a bunch of language creep in, and I want to just explain why, okay? So this is just a comment. It's not going to take me long. And the reason we've been forced to think about the language we use is really due to dark energy. But we should have done it before. Now, I've talked about k equals 0, k equals 1, k equals minus 1 universes. And I talked about the fact that, indeed, you have a Big Bang at the beginning. And we talked about matter and radiation as reasonable sources. And remember that if you put matter and radiation in, if For example, then you get so you know how the scale factor evolves. But what that means, you'll soon see, is that if they're the only things in the universe, then if you plot A of t, then there's three real possibilities for what's going to happen to the universe. Either k will be negative, minus 1. And if you look at the Friedmann equation, that just tells you that this is a sum of positive things. I'm just talking about radiation and matter now. If k is negative, this is a positive thing. So this will just go on forever. You'll always expand. H dot will never be 0. And so you'll get behavior like that. So I should specify this is only radiation and matter, nothing else I want to talk about yet. K equals 0, then you have exactly the critical density. What happens is you expand forever, but that term dilutes, and you asymptotically are going to stop, but it's only asymptotic, so you expand forever. And if k equals plus 1, then, as I think someone in here was pointing out earlier, there'll be a trade-off between these two terms, and h will go to 0, and actually the universe will turn around. And what'll happen is we'll do that, and you'll end up in what's called a big crunch. These universes are, the way to think about the dynamics of these is very simple. This is just as if you took a ball and threw it into the surface of the off the surface of the Earth into the air with differing velocities. That's one way to think about it. Perhaps a more accurate analogy is take a ball, throw it into the surface into the air with a given speed, and do it on several different planets, some of which have a very small amount of mass, some of which have a huge amount of mass, and one of which has the absolutely baby bear perfect amount of mass. And if you do, the difference between those things is, of course, that if you're on a small enough planet, not enough stuff, negative k, then you'll exceed the escape velocity, and the ball will escape forever. If you on a very large planet, you will have lots of stuff, k equals plus 1, the ball will eventually come back down. If you just fix things right, you'll be exactly the escape velocity, you'll go off forever, asymptotically coming to a stop. Okay. And because of this, this destiny of the universe in these models, forever expanding, never coming to a stop, just right, and decreasing, these universes got names. This one, of course, got the uninspired name flat. But this got the name, this, of course, gets called a hyperbolic universe because it's negatively curved. But what it really often gets called is open. And it still gets called open, that's okay, but the point is that people associate that with meaning it'll expand forever. Similarly here, this gets the name closed, and this is the thing, or spherical. And closed, of course, you think of closed, finite, and it's going to recollapse, okay? So it's recollapse. And the point I just want to make here is that while it's hyperbolic and spherical and flat are correct local statements about the geometry of these spaces, and why it's okay, if you like, to call them open and closed, although not particularly helpful, certainly you can't infer anything about the destiny, because as we know nowadays, if you have a component of, say, a cosmological constant in there, or dark energy, it's possible for even a closed universe, so with less than the critical density in stuff in here, if some of that is a cosmological constant, and there's enough of it, that universe will expand forever, no matter what. Okay, so this connection between the geometry and destiny is gone now that we know about the possibility of dark energy and a cosmological constant. Also, I really don't like these terms open and closed, really, because open here makes you feel like, well, it's infinite, it goes on forever, but you know, this is only, it's only the covering space that's hyperbolic, right? There's no reason I can't make identifications under freely acting subgroups of the isometries and make this a compact hyperbolic space. So it doesn't tell us anything about, GR doesn't tell us about the global structure of these spaces, is the only point I wanted to make here. So I will occasionally say open and closed, but mostly spherical, hyperbolic, and flat. And you should be aware, I mean, you are aware, but I just want to make it clear, that it tells us nothing about the end evolution of the universe. That depends on what types of matter are in there, and also whether they decay into one another. Okay. Good. Let me go over here. So having convinced you that we can make sensible choices for the matter content of the universe, that we can then, and that those choices, you know, they're not just sensible kind of because we can solve the equations, but they correspond to some things we find in our universe. We can solve the equations, we can figure out how the evolution will go. What happens when we go out and measure the universe? What do we see out there? So we move on to the universe today and get a little bit into this and complete it next time. So here, I don't want to go into excruciating detail about how cosmological observations and measurements are made for two reasons. One, it's not really what I want, what I think the purpose of this talk is. I think the purpose of my lectures is to get you to a stage where you can then go on and listen to Henry's talk and Lev's talk, and partly because it's actually kind of complicated. It's not something that I'm the world's expert on. I mean, these things are very technical these days, but I do want to give you a feeling for what comes out of observing the universe today. The Hubble constant, so one thing you'd really like to know is how fast are distant galaxies moving away from us. We have a lot of good measures of these days, but the best ones are coming from the Hubble Space Telescope Key Project, which has really done amazing work and will cease to do amazing work when Hubble crashes into the atmosphere at some point. But Hubble parameter, we know now, and it's usually parameterized in the following way, and there's an unfortunate duplication of notation here, but I can't help it, is 100 h kilometers per second per megaparsec. So those are the right units. And h here is about 0.71 plus or minus 0.06. So this is what people mean when they say the Hubble constant today is about 71, 72. They mean that, kilometers per second per megaparsec. And like I said, there are many different ways in which we'll get at this, but the Hubble Key Project is probably the best. This was something of controversy for a while in cosmology, but perhaps in recent years not so much so as the question of the other side of the Einstein equation, namely, what are the different components of stuff that make up the universe? Now, one thing has been clear for a very long time, and that is that no matter whether the universe has exactly the critical density, or less than the critical density, or more than the critical density, you absolutely will need to have more matter out there than the matter you see glowing in the night sky. And, yes, 10 minutes? Okay, thank you. So I'm going to come back and say more about that in the next lecture, but the main reason you know that is that we have a very good handle on the abundances of the light elements in the universe, so-called Big Bang nucleosynthesis. We know from measuring the abundances of the light elements in the universe to a very good approximation how much luminous matter, and by that I mean protons, basically, how many protons were out there in the early universe. And it's much, much, much less than can account for all the mass that holds together galaxies. And that's been known for a long time. You've heard about this, I'm sure. People talk about the rotation curves of galaxies, but these days there's many, many bits of other evidence. So it's clear that the matter in the universe goes beyond the visible matter, the kind of stuff that we're made of. The question is, what is it? Okay. Nowadays, people know quite well what the measurement of the totality of that matter is. So baryonic plus this weird stuff that holds together galaxies. And they get it in a variety of ways. So you get omega matter is about, and I'm going to be very loose here, 0.25. And the reason I'm not going into lots of other units, other not giving you error bars, et cetera, because there are different error bars depending on which measurements you take into account, but they all are consistent. And so this is a measure not only, this measures both baryons and some hypothetical component, which I'm going to call dark matter. We know independently, so measurements of this, they come from looking at the dynamics of galaxies, looking at the dynamics of clusters of galaxies, looking at peculiar velocities of galaxies within clusters of galaxies. And ultimately, these days, they come from measurements of the microwave background radiation. I'm going to have more to say about that. Okay? But one thing we know, as I just said, is that omega matter is 0.25. This contains much more stuff than the baryons. And in fact, omega baryon, which is, you know, contained within omega matter, is about 0.05. And we know that, as I said, from measurements of the abundances of the light elements. Okay? The way that works is that the light elements were formed during fusion processes in the early universe. Hydrogen fuses to helium, and helium-3, and helium-4, and deuterium, lithium. And while that's going on, the universe is expanding and cooling, so it only lasts for a short amount of time. And it's very sensitive to the initial amount of matter in the universe. And we make very precise measurements of the abundances of the light elements. That tells you how many protons should have been around initially. That's where you get this measurement from. Nowadays, we have a consistent measurement of this, semi-independently from the microwave background radiation. Okay? So this is a solid number. This is a number for all the kind of, by matter here, remember, I mean non-relativistic dust in the universe. So there's a lot, much larger amount of stuff in the universe than there is glowing. Now, let me say one last thing in my last 10 minutes. And that is, I'm going to spend almost no time telling you about the supernovae, which have made a big impact in cosmology. When I told you that distant galaxies are moving away from us, I told you that it fit very well the Hubble law. So V is HD. Okay? So if you can look at further and further away objects, you can measure their distance and you can measure their speed using spectroscopy, so looking at the redshift of their spectral lines, you can get a better and better handle on this behavior. This is an approximate behavior. You have to put corrections in here at larger distances. But you can get a better and better handle on this. And in fact, the way in which distant galaxies move away from us is, of course, sensitive to the cosmology, to how much stuff is out there in the universe, the cosmic history. And in recent years, say starting, the data started to come in around 97, people have started to realize there's a new class of objects which work very well as so-called standard candles, or more accurately, standardizable candles. And these are objects who, if you look at how bright they are, you can figure out how far away they are, essentially. And in, sorry, wrong thing to say, that they all have the same brightness. And so if you know, if you can calibrate them from nearby ones, you can figure out how far away the far away ones are. Supernovae 1A do not all have exactly the same brightness, but there's a way to standardize them to treat them as standard candles. And I'm not going to go into that, of course. The point is that they give you a handle on this plot out to high redshift. And high redshift for cosmologists in this context means redshifts of 1 and above. And if you do that, you end up with a Hubble plot. Okay? And I could plot it just as well as, you know, it's H of T, or I could plot it as A of T if you like, or H of Z. And the point is we know where we are today, and the question is what happened in the past. And if I plot it on this plot for a moment, or something like it, here we are today, so we normalize everything to today. How's the scale factor behaving? It's here. And then you look back in the past, and you know, if we're decelerating, you kind of expect to be doing this, but what we actually see is this kind of behavior. So the scale factor is increasing. So I'll show a better plot of this tomorrow, but the point I'm trying to make is that what we're finding today is that the universe is accelerating. Not only that, what the microwave background tells us, and again, something I will get to tomorrow, is that if you add up all the stuff in the universe, omega total is 1. So I know I'm glossing over a couple of facts here, it's because I want to get to kind of a stopping point today, but I'll reiterate some of these in more detail at the beginning of tomorrow. And obviously, if omega total is 1, and omega matter is 0.25, there's a difference between those two, and there must be something there. And so this is why people tell you that there's something called dark energy today, with omega dark energy approximately 0.75. There's a lot of it, and it must be pretty weird because not only is it the dominant thing in the universe, but yet, you know, not something we measure in this room, but also it should be the thing that's causing the universe to accelerate, because the other stuff we've accounted for certainly does not do that. Matter causes deceleration. You could test that. You could see that quite easily from here. Okay. So I'm going to kind of stop in a moment. So let me kind of recap what I've done today. So today I've kind of done a lot of the kind of nuts and bolts work. I've written down homogeneity and isotropy. I've showed you the kind of line elements you're allowed to have with that constraint. I've showed you what the Einstein equations become with that ansatz and assuming a similarly homogeneous and isotropic matter sources, energy and momentum sources, namely the perfect fluids. And then we specialized to cases of dust, which for my purposes are galaxies or clusters of galaxies, and radiation, which you can think of as the microwave background radiation, but anyway, radiation gases in space. And we've derived how the scale factor, the distance between co-moving objects, changes as cosmic time evolves in universes dominated by one or the other of these components. And I've done that both for the flat case and for the curved cases. We talked a little bit about horizons, which are important kind of causal aspects of these spacetimes. I'll be coming back to them when I talk about inflation. And I've tried to finish up here by giving you an extremely abbreviated accounting of what kind of stuff is in the universe as measured by astronomers. And I'll say a little bit more about this next time. And now we've built up this, in the next lecture, what I hope to do is move on, talk a little bit about dark energy in terms of, you know, what problems does it present for fundamental physics, and then move on and start talking about the early universe and the issues that are presented to us by the type of universe we find ourselves in today. So we're going to have to understand, where is it that, why do we have so many baryons? Why is it 0.05 omega baryon? Why is omega matter 0.25? And in particular, what is the rest of that matter? What might that be from a fundamental physics viewpoint? What's dark energy? What can possibly do this? And we'll talk about a cosmological constant. I'll try to get through most of that tomorrow and tell you something about inflation. Thanks. Thank you. Hey, how are you?
How are you?
Good, nice to see you.
I have a very simple question for you.
Sure.
So if you keep the energy density fixed, and you vary the little omega, so the equation of state parameter.
W.
So you increase the pressure. What happens is that the scale factor by this formula.
Oh, this is only a solution for constant W.
Yeah.
Okay. So
let me. Saying,